Good evening. Thank you for coming out tonight. My name's John Haynes. I'm a member of the Friends Executive Committee and chair of the Friends Programming Committee. It's my pleasure to welcome you tonight and to introduce what I think has been my favorite book of the last year, introduce our speaker, Karina Urbach. Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Historical Research at the University of London, Dr. Urbach is currently a long-term visitor here in the School of Historical Studies. She was educated in Europe, earning her BA in Modern History, Politics, and Medieval History at Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, a Master of Philosophy in International Relations at the University of Cambridge, where she also earned her PhD. Prior to her appointment at University of London, she was a Research Fellow at the German Historical Institute, London, Assistant Professor of Modern History at the University of Bayreuth, and for 3 years she conducted independent research financed by the Bavarian Ministry of Culture as a recipient of the Habitations Prize. Her research interests include German and British cultural and political relations in the 19th and 20th century, the history of international relations, and Jewish family history. She received several awards in Europe for her scholarship, and since 2010 she has served on the board of the Otto von Bismarck Foundation. Dr. Urbach has authored numerous articles and 3 books, Bismarck's Favorite Englishman, Lord Otto Russell's Mission to Berlin, Queen Victoria, and most recently, Go-Betweens for Hitler. She has made frequent appearances on radio and television, and she has served as an historical advisor for both television and film. The Friends are delighted to welcome Karina and her husband, Professor Jonathan Haslam, to the community, and very much appreciate that she has taken time this evening to speak to the Friends group. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Karina Urbach.
Thank you very much. Yes, thank you very much, John, and thanks for inviting me. Thank you to the Friends of the IAS. It's wonderful to be here. I hope you can hear me. Professor Levine has said, you know, I should speak up. I'm sorry for this shameless plug here, but I'm going to talk about my book because it came out last year, and there were quite a few interesting things happening around it. And when I first went on a sort of book tour, I was invited to a wonderful country house in Norfolk. It was really like Downton Abbey. It felt like the remains of the day, and I thought it went quite well. It was, the local history group was there. Lots of dignitaries, the Lord of the Manor, everybody, and in the Q&A, suddenly everything went wrong because there was a very angry lady in her late 80s getting up, and she was red-faced, and she said, you have just insulted my godmother because you said in your talk that Lady Diana Mitford was a Nazi groupie, that she was a Hitler groupie. And I can just tell you that this woman was the most charming lady I've ever met. And she once told me that the reason why she was attracted to Hitler was because he was such a charming man. So I won't tell you what my reply was, but I was never invited back. So that was the last time I've ever been invited to a country house in Norfolk. But it was an interesting experience. And it got worse shortly afterwards because I got a few more angry emails when this story came out. And I think this story wasn't covered so much in America, but in Britain it was a huge scoop. It came out in July last year. And it is a story run by The Sun, which is a British tabloid. It's a part of the Murdoch Group. And perhaps you can see the people in the picture. There is on the right the Duke of Windsor. We know him as the Duke of Windsor now. At the time, he was Prince of Wales. Then there's the Queen, being 7 or 8 years old. We never found out whether this footage was taken in 33 or 34. And then there is the Queen Mother doing this. I mean, we know her as the Queen Mother today. In those days, she was the Duchess of York. So, of course, lots of people said this is absolutely tasteless. How could you get involved with this story? How could you be the historical advisor to The Sun and support this story? Well, there were lots of reasons why I got involved, and I hope I can explain this to you. It had nothing to do with money. Why did I get into this? It is a freedom of information issue, in my opinion, because to this very day, we historians have great problems getting into the Royal Archives in Windsor. We can't get any material about the interwar years. We can't get anything on the 1930s. And that we accidentally found this footage and could release it was a godsend to the historians, because you soon realize that once it is put in a historical context, it is very, very important. It's not just a tasteless photo. So, okay, how did this all start? Did I want to get into trouble? No, I didn't. I didn't want to insult anybody's godmother, and I certainly didn't want to insult the Queen, because I met her once, and I think she's a formidable lady. And, of course, she's totally innocent. She's a child in this picture. No, I didn't want to insult anyone. I started off by working on the European aristocracy, and my project was quite simple. I wanted to find out their survival techniques. How does an elite, an old elite that is under enormous pressure, especially at the end of the 19th century, but also after the First World War, how does this elite survive? How does it survive economically, politically, and socially? So it was quite a harmless project, I thought. And unfortunately, it turned out into becoming very political, because during my research, reading their letters, I realized that some of these members of the nobility used their niche influence and became back channels. They became back channels to very important politicians, democratic elected politicians like Chamberlain, but also to dictators. And some of my colleagues who are here tonight have already heard my series on back channels and my work on back channels and how important they are in politics. So tonight I will just focus on one person, the greatest networker of all, who also will lead us back to this story and will explain this story, because he is a man who was very close to Edward VIII, to the Duke of Windsor. So this man is absolutely obscure. He wasn't known until quite recently. And here on this photo, you can see him as a toddler. He looks very sweet and innocent. They always do when they're young. So, quite a charming little boy. He's sitting on his mother's lap, and she is a German princess who married into the royal family. His name is Charles Edward. I'll call him Charlie in the following, because that's what the family called him, Charlie. It's easier because all these members of the nobility keep changing their names during their lifetime. So Charlie, and then on the left you can see his sister Alice. Now Alice is becoming very important later on, always getting him out of difficult situations, and she's very much helping him later on, establishing contacts with high-ranking British politicians. So Alice and Charlie live an absolutely not a very spectacular life, being grandchildren of Queen Victoria, a very privileged life, but they are one of many grandchildren, and so nobody really cares much about their future. He just goes to Eton, and he's expected to be joining the military or becoming a landowner. But then at 15, his life changes completely. He has to leave Eton because something becomes available in the family, some inheritance, and that's the inheritance. So this is the Feste in Coburg. Coburg is a little town in nowadays it's in Bavaria. Of course, it used to be in 1914. It used to be a duchy, a sovereign little place, and he becomes the Duke of Coburg and Gotha. And this is one of his many castles. The Feste is very spectacular to this day because tourists love it. Martin Luther lived there, worked there for a while. So this Feste is, for German Protestants, it's an important place to go to. So he has this enormous inheritance. Everything goes well for a while. He marries. He has lots of children. And then in 1914, of course, the war breaks out. And up till then, he was able to commute between Britain and Germany. But all of a sudden, of course, he has to take sides. So his problem is, does he feel British? Does he feel German? He decides with the German side. And he becomes a very big patriot, very German nationalist, very much on the radical right already during the war. And he also decides that he doesn't want anything to do with the British royal family anymore. He gives up all these high-ranking positions he has in British officer corps. And he also decides that the British no longer are allowed to have his name. Because that's a funny thing, you know, the British royal family, of course, wasn't called Windsor until 1917. They were called, their house was called Sachsen-Coburg-Gotha. So they are called after this little place, Coburg. And he tells them in 1917, you can't have that name anymore, you're not members of my house anymore, you are enemies. And they retaliate. They say to him, you are a traitor peer, you are not a peer of Britain anymore, we don't want anything to do with you. So, as we know, the House of Windsor changes its name to Windsor in 1917. So they become a different house, but you would think that after this disaster and this clash within the family, they never talk to each other again. And that would be in a normal family. That's what happens. If your uncle says you can't keep the family name anymore, you are an outsider, how do you react? Of course, you are terribly upset. But exactly that doesn't happen. And after 1918, the British royal family embraces him again and says, you know, the honor of the house has to stay intact. We want you to be part of our house again. You can come back. But who are they embracing? And that's the problem now, because he has changed. He has been so radicalized by everything that happened in Germany in 1918. You probably know about the revolutions that were going on in Germany, in Berlin and in Munich. There are big clashes between the radical right and the communists, and he is very much involved in that. So at the same time that Adolf Hitler writes in Mein Kampf, you know, November 1918, I cried and couldn't stop crying, Coburg, or Charlie Coburg, has exactly the same experience. He can't stop crying as well. And unfortunately, he decides very much like Hitler at that very moment that he wants to become a politician. And we know that it went badly for both of them. So in 1918, they don't know each other, they haven't met each other yet, but they are coming already closer to each other. And Charlie Coburg now starts to support radical right-wing terrorist organizations. So you have to imagine, this is a grandson of Queen Victoria. This is a very respectable man who suddenly gets so upset about the defeat of Germany, about the losses he has. Lots of course, he loses money as well from the revolution. So he gets so radicalized that he now supports an organization that is called Consul. It's a terrorist organization that kills commits several murders. Our finance minister was killed by them. Our foreign secretary was killed. So you can imagine he is not pulling the trigger himself, but he is loading the gun. He finances the murderers who come from Coburg, with Rathenau, with the murder of our foreign secretary. That was a Coburger. And he pays for the weapons. And he does something even worse. In 1922, he invites Hitler to Coburg. So the whole Nazi party is coming to the Feste. You can see the Feste up there, his little castle. And you can see all these supporters, Hitler supporters, with Hitler coming to Coburg. Of course, Hitler in 1922 was a nobody. He was one of many leaders of the radical right, and his party was very local. It was a Bavarian party. But now suddenly he's invited by a duke, which is, of course, for him an enormous honor. And he's invited to spend the day with his party members and smash up the local socialists. And he does that very well. Apparently, Hitler got physical there for the first time and the last time. Usually he had other people doing these things for him. But he's involved in the street fights. He's giving his usual rants in the evening. And Coburg, this day in Coburg, becomes one of the founding myths of the Nazi party. And Hitler mentions it in his autobiography. He mentions it in Mein Kampf as that wonderful day where he, you know, realized his movement has a chance to become bigger. So he owns all this to Charlie Coburg, and the two men stay in touch. They realize they need each other, they might help each other. And the reason why Hitler needs somebody like Charlie is pretty obvious. I mean, first of all, he needs his money. The Coburgs are still very rich. And then, of course, he needs him as a sort of door opener, because Hitler is still a nobody and he wants social contact. So Charlie can give him this on a local level, regional in Bavaria, but also on a national level. He can introduce him to the great industrialists. He can introduce him to other big names in Germany. And Hitler, which is very interesting in Mein Kampf, says, you know, a lot of negative things about the nobility, but at the end of the day, he, for example, says they are degenerate and they are inbreeding and they are always, you know, marrying their cousin and things like that. But at the end of the day, he uses them, and he uses them really well. It goes pretty well for the two of them, but most importantly, of course, Hitler needs Charlie's international contacts. And now that's where we are coming back to the British royal family. Because Hitler's biggest dream is to have this alliance with the British, you know, the Anglo-German alliance. That's his big dream, so that he can concentrate on Russia, on the Soviet Union. And he hopes that he can finally pull this off with people like Charlie. And he uses a lot of high-ranking German nobility to send to Britain for propaganda purposes, but Charlie is his most important weapon. And now, strangely enough, Charlie, despite all the problems in the First World War, gets received in all these drawing rooms in Britain again. And he gets received because his sister Alice has married back in the British royal family and helps him. And she still has a country house. He has lost his in the First World War. So he entertains at his sister's country house all these very influential British politicians. He entertains Chamberlain and he meets Duff Cooper. And the biggest prize that everybody wanted, of course, at the time, the great social trophy, is the Prince of Wales, is the man we know as Duke of Windsor, the one you saw earlier. Wait a second. That, the one on the right. So that's the big social trophy. Everybody wants him because, you know, every mother wants their daughter to marry him, and every person wants to befriend this man of the future. It explains in some ways also while the Queen Mother is so close to him, because she knows he's going to be the next king, so she always wants to please him. So everybody wants to win him over, and the Prince of Wales is very receptive. He is very interested in Germany for many reasons, because his mother, of course, Queen Mary, is German. She always brought her children up to believe into the roots of their house and to remember that Germany is the country where they come from. But he's also very attracted to Germany because he's attracted to the Nazi movement. And that's something that is a bit, is to this day always debated, how much of a Nazi was he, how much is that all conspiracy theory, or was he really so interested in Hitler? Well, he says in 1933 about the Nazi Party, of course it is the only thing to do, we will have to come to it as we are in great danger from the communists too. So in some ways, I would think it's already obvious in 1933 where he's going. And he does even more. During his short reign, and as you all know, he only reigned for a year because he got into personal trouble with his wife, Wallace Simpson. But he's only king for 10 months. But during these 10 months, he's quite pro-German in everything he does. There is the Rhineland crisis, where he is completely siding with Hitler. That's one of the many crises of the 1930s, where Hitler is breaking every clause in the Treaty of Locarno, and the Western powers are doing nothing. So whenever Hitler is trying to commit one of these crimes, he always sends over Charlie Coburg to Britain as a back channel. He always has him there while on the official side, of course, the diplomats talk, but Charlie Coburg always goes for behind-the-scenes work and is very successful. And in 1936, he reports back, for example, the British king sees an alliance with Germany as a necessity. It has to become a leitmotif of British foreign policy. And he also claims that the Prince of Wales has told him, I myself wish to talk to Hitler and will do so here or in Germany. Tell him that, please. So this man is very, very eager on Germany. So I think that case is pretty obvious. It becomes even more obvious later on when I show you a few more archive quotes that I had the chance to find out. Now, here, of course, you can see the reward for this. So Charlie does this back channel work, and of course the Nazi Party rewards him for it, and he gets a front row seat. You can see perhaps, wait a second. Yeah, so this is Amy Sonnemann, the wife of Göring. There's Göring, there is the Polish ambassador, and there is Charlie Coburg, and there is Goebbels. So this is really the best front row seat you can have if you want to mingle in these kind of circles. Yeah, so he gets always the first row from now on. He gets rewarded in many different ways. There he is together with Hitler. This is in Coburg. There is, of course, Hitler, and here is Charlie Coburg, always sitting next to him. They are celebrating the 15 years anniversary of coming back to Coburg. So, yes, he does get these rewards. He also gets financial rewards. So he's the recipient of the Dispositionsfonds, which is a money fund that Hitler has for all his chosen people, for people who do this behind-the-scenes work for him. And Charlie gets, I think in today's money, it would be $20,000 a month for this kind of back-channel work. So he's very well paid. He gets lots of honorary positions. He becomes the head of the Red Cross. and many other things. And he gets also lots of uniforms. He always loves wearing uniforms. So Hitler gives him a general uniform and every uniform he wants. So yeah, he's quite happy about all this. So it is going really well for him. But then, of course, Edward VIII, the Duke of Windsor, abdicates, and that is a big blow, because he is the main back channel for Charlie for all his alliance work in Britain. And this abdication, which is because of Wallace Simpson, is a disaster. But strangely enough, the Nazi Party and Charlie take it very coolly and don't overreact, and they don't cover it in a negative way in the press. So why is that? Why are they so cautious? Well, they have different plans now. They want to target the new couple, the new royal couple, and that's why she is important again. They want to cover her now. They want to court her. They want to win her over. The Queen Mother, at this time, you know, Queen Elizabeth, she has the same name as her daughter, which is really confusing. So the daughter is called, as we know, the daughter today is Elizabeth III, but the mother is also called Elizabeth. So at the time, she becomes Queen Elizabeth and the wife of George VI. So she is important now. And Charlie Coburg is very interested in her and her husband. And that is why I got into so much trouble, because she is very, very popular in Britain to this day. And that everybody associates her with the big effort during the war, when she walked to the rebel, you know, London was bombed, of course, and it was her who was very patriotic, and she went to the sites, and she really did her bit. She supported, of course, the war effort wholeheartedly, and so did the Queen, who became a car mechanic, and they did everything during the war. They did everything right, and of course, they were absolutely not pro-Nazi. But the question that has always hung over all of this is, what did she do before the war started? So that was always the tricky bit. What were her political opinions until 39? That from 39 onwards, she is absolutely loyal, of course, is clear. Well, the truth is that she was absolutely not interested in Churchill, that she and her husband were very critical of Churchill, who, of course, always said we have to stand up to the Nazis. She was very much pro-Chamberlain, so she was an appeaser. She wanted to avoid the war by all means, and she hung on to Chamberlain as long as possible, she and her husband. Perhaps we should say that the person who filmed this footage, we didn't know for sure, but because it was in a sequence of films, we have a pretty good guess that the cameraman who has filmed and taken these photos was George VI, because he was very keen on filming his children, and he did all the other films of the royal family. So the question is now, is he encouraging his children to do that? Is the Duke of Windsor encouraging the children? Well, most probably he was. Of course, it's 33, it's not 39, this footage. So it's very early on in the movement. The George VI was an appeaser. He was pro-Chamberlain, like his wife. And to the very end, well into the summer of 39, he sends one of his brothers over to Germany for last effort to stop the war and to talk via a relative with Hitler. So that was something that wasn't known until a few months ago either. And the question how do they behave was, of course, now vital to our the whole story about the royal couple. And a lot of royal historians got terribly upset about it, that we questioned their politics, that we that the son was indicating that there might be something more fishy happening here. So there was a big backlash about that. But I think I could quite convincingly prove that Charlie again is visiting the royal couple during the decisive moments of the Munich Agreement in 38, in the whole summer of 38 to September 38, and constantly trying to put pressure on them. And as you know, the Munich Agreement was, of course, signed by Chamberlain, and the king, George VI, and his wife were terribly enthusiastic about the Munich Agreement and were so eager to celebrate Chamberlain that they even wanted to go to the airport to collect him. That was something that in the end was they were told they shouldn't do that. They shouldn't be too over-enthusiastic. But whenever anybody criticized the Munich Agreement and Chamberlain, the royal family, especially Queen Mary, got very upset, and George VI, and they said the Munich Agreement was the right thing to do. Of course, that's something they don't claim anymore after 39. So Charlie Coburg puts pressure on them. He is a back channel to them, but he's also playing both sides because he's still a back channel to the other men. He still works with the Duke of Windsor. He still organizes the Duke of Windsor's trip to Germany. He makes sure that the Duke of Windsor meets Hitler. And he plays both kings, really. He's very clever about that. And that the Duke of Windsor was guilty, I think we can all agree on. And I think I was very lucky because one of the quotes I found in the Franco papers that had been overlooked up till then shows absolutely convincingly that the Duke of Windsor was a traitor to his own country. The quote is interesting because he was talking to a Spanish diplomat, a friend of his, who immediately reported all of these conversations to Franco. And he says to the Spanish diplomat, on 25th of June 1940, the war is on, you know, Churchill is in power. But he says to him, if the Germans bomb England effectively, this could bring peace. The Duke of Windsor seems very much to hope that this would occur. He wants peace at any price. And he also criticizes Churchill and the British government and the Bermejillo reports to Franco, he throws all the blame on the Jews and the Reds and Eden with his people in the Foreign Office and other politicians, all of whom he would have liked to put up against the wall. So I think he's pretty guilty. And if you say that your own country should be bombed, I don't know. I think that is quite convincingly showing he's guilty. But I was very lucky because I'm married to a Russianist, and he got me another nice quote because I can't read Russian. I could do the Spanish, but I couldn't do the Russian. And he got me a wonderful quote that he found in the intelligence paper, in the Russian intelligence papers, which also shows how guilty the Duke of Windsor was. And that was a report that came to the Kremlin, a memo saying the former King of England, Edward, together with his wife Simpson, is at present in Madrid, where he is in touch with Hitler. Edward is conducting negotiations with Hitler on the question of the formation of a new English government and the conclusion of peace with Germany, contingent on a military alliance against the USSR. So, that was pretty bad. And that's why I think the Sun was absolutely right in covering the story, and it was absolutely right in asking these questions about the Queen Mother as well. Her official biographer doesn't agree with me. We had a few radio discussions, which was funny, really. But what happens to Charlie now? When war breaks out, he plays this Duke of Windsor, and he can't play, of course, anymore at George VI. That's gone. But Hitler uses him for other back-channeling. He uses him in Sweden because he is also related to the Swedish royal family, and as you all know, Sweden is neutral during the Second World War, neutral in, well, not really neutral. They do help the Nazis enormously. And they are very much pro-Hitler. So he works in Sweden, and he does other back-channeling to Japan. And he also visits Molotov shortly before Hitler attacks the Soviet Union. So he's very, very busy. But it comes to nothing in the end, because Hitler then doesn't need these back channels anymore. Of course, when the war is becoming worse and worse for him, he suddenly makes very strange decisions about his former back channels. And that was something that I found very surprising, because I suddenly came to a quote in which where Hitler gives the order, saying, "The Führer attaches, Hitler attaches importance to the Duke of Coburg on no accounts falling into enemy hands." So when I read this quote for the first time, I didn't quite understand. It's April 45, and what does he mean? He doesn't want him on no accounts falling into enemy hands. This is a man he has worked with for 20 years. Does he care about him? I mean, does he want him to be taken into safety? Of course not. I mean, that's not Hitler. I mean, Hitler doesn't care about people. He cares about his dog. But so at the time he gives this order, he is handing out to his secretaries and to everyone else these cyanide capsules and says, let's commit suicide together. So I realized, it took me some time, I realized that this was an order he was giving for the Duke to be killed. I mean, this was a Nero order. This meant, try to get rid of him somehow. And why did he want to get rid of him? Well, because he shared too many secrets with him. He was his back channel to too many countries, and he didn't want him to stay alive. Well, he wasn't successful anymore. It was too late. It was April 45, and the Duke of Coburg survives. Now, when he survives, he, of course, wants to survive in style, and doesn't want to go to prison, but the Americans catch him. And the Americans put him into a camp for a while, and it is his sister again who gets him out of this problem. She is quite outraged that what she has to do. She writes in her memoirs, "In our efforts to do something for Charlie, my husband and I humiliated ourselves by dining with the U.S. governor of Coburg, a Syrian by birth. We also called on and lunched with his successor, a Jewish French American, whom we did not think a suitable representative of this great country, nor the sort of person one would select to instruct the Germans in democracy." So, she's quite a tough one, then, lady. So she does get Coburg out of the camp. She does get Charlie out of this camp, and she does get him some money back, so he can retire in Coburg, and he does die under normal circumstances in 1954. And of course, the Duke of Windsor also goes on to live his hedonistic jet set life and dies in the 70s and never has to stand trial for any kind of treason and lives happily ever after. So do I think it was important? Yes, I think it was important to show this footage, because we never get a glimpse into the Royal Archives, and this footage was released by accident. But it was, for us historians, a really important accident, because many of the quotes I have presented to you today were quotes that I also got by accident, because when I worked in the Royal Archives, they said to me, "I can't see any papers from the 1930s, but I can see some from the 1920s. So they probably thought the 1920s are harmless, because they didn't know that Charlie was already financing terrorist organizations in the 1920s. They didn't know that he was already already meeting Hitler, and that they courted each other, that they were attracted to each other. So that's why they gave me these quotes. That was terribly helpful. Of course, they didn't know they were helpful. So, yes, I think it's a freedom of information issue, and perhaps the British can learn from the Americans, where it is much easier to get archive material, where you have different rules, because in Britain at the moment, they have a lot of discussions. They want to cut the freedom of information. They want to release less material to us instead of more. And I think that would be quite a disaster, because for us historians, if you want to understand what happened in the 1930s, if you want to understand appeasement and also the role of these people who are important, then we need access to the files. So give us the files. Thank you.